Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki declines to participate in a unity government. UK Prime Minister David Cameron continues to scatter attacks in Jean-Claude Juncker's path to the EU presidency. And Russia says it won't invade Ukraine, this week at least. I'll be joined by Ivor Geber of City University and Nina Schick of Open Europe to discuss the day's news. Also ahead...
I really do feel Chiellini felt the bite from Suarez, and that's why he reacted with an elbow like that.
All football didn't want for Christmas. Luis Suarez's front teeth dominating back pages again. And before the end of the programme, we'll bring you another of our alternative World Cup anthems today. We're in Switzerland, a nation of regions still in search of a sense of self.
This sort of singing goes back to about the 16th century, and it's very much like an appreciation for the mountains and nature, and it kind of picks up the old tales of the old ghosts and the old mystical land of the mountains.
All that, plus we'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world and review the latest dance openings. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. So lots coming up in the next hour, but before all that, Suzanne Chislett has the latest news.
The US Secretary of State John Kerry will visit Saudi Arabia on Friday for more discussions on the crises in Iraq and Syria.
In order to meet with His Majesty King Abdullah and to discuss regional issues, including the situation in Iraq, and how we can counter the shared threat that is posed by ISIL, as well as to discuss our support for the moderate opposition in Syria.
Members of Al-Qaeda in Syria have pledged their support to ISIS in at least one key border town. The Sunni insurgent groups continuing to battle government forces in Iraq. Today it seized control of a major airbase and several small oil fields. Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has rejected international calls to form a new all-inclusive government to shore up support against the Sunni militants. He used his weekly address to say such a move would mark an end to democracy in Iraq. Around 500,000 people are now thought to have fled their homes in the north of the country as the violence continues. The World Food Programme's Erthurin Cousin appealed for more aid to help them.
We need the international community to continue to support our efforts here so that no family who has now come to find refuge goes without the basic food, water, and other assistance needs that the UN community and WFP is working to provide to them.
The presidents of Russia, Germany, France, and Ukraine have held a joint phone conference to discuss the situation in Ukraine. The Kremlin says Vladimir Putin called for the temporary ceasefire between Kiev and some separatist rebel groups to be extended beyond Friday. Russia has faced international criticism for failing to stop the pro-Russian rebels from fighting the Ukrainian government. Authorities in Nigeria say they found no proof that around 60 people have been kidnapped in another mass abduction in Borno State. Reports on Tuesday suggested the militant Boko Haram group may have snatched more women and children from rural villages. But the government-run National Information Centre insists the media reports are incorrect. More than 200 schoolgirls are still being held by the group following their kidnapping in March. Sudan has summoned the US and South Sudanese ambassadors over the new detention of a Christian convert who was trying to fly to the United States. Mariam Yahya Ibrahim was freed from prison on Monday. She'd been sentenced to death for refusing to renounce her faith after marrying an American. As she tried to board a plane to the US, the 27-year-old, her husband and their two children were detained again. Sudan's accused her of trying to use false documents. It doesn't recognize the South Sudanese papers she was using, as it also doesn't recognize her marriage. Her attorney is Sharif Ali.
This allegation is not true. As the South Sudanese embassy here, they came today into the police station and they have confirmed to the police that this document is correct and they are the one who issued this document. So as long as the South Sudanese confirm this information, this means the case should be dismissed.
Poland's Prime Minister Donald Tusk is to seek a confidence vote from Parliament after secret recordings of senior officials plunged the country into its worst political crisis for years. It's not known who made tapes of senior officials as they lunched in a popular restaurant in Warsaw. Some of the experts released to the media suggest a man identified as Poland's foreign minister, Radoslaw Sikorski, believes the alliance with the US is worthless and the UK Prime Minister David Cameron incompetent in EU affairs. And North Korea has threatened merciless retaliation if an upcoming Hollywood film is released. It's thought the interview about a talk show host and a producer who fly to Pyongyang and are recruited by the CIA to assassinate Kim Jong-un has angered the state's leader. A foreign ministry spokesman is quoted by local news agencies as saying he would consider the release of the film an act of war. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Yet again, somebody reviewing a film before they've even seen it. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is nearly 18.07, which will be 13.07 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio, we have Ivor Gaber, who's Director of the Political Journalism MA at City University here in London, and Nina Schick, Communications Director at the Open Europe Think Tank. Welcome to you both. We'll start once again in Iraq, where Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has rejected suggestions that he form a so-called National Salvation Government, which at this point feels akin to the captain of the Titanic rejecting a new layout of the deck chairs. Ivor, I'll start with you to deploy a couple of favourite journalese words of my own, at least. On the scale from embattled to beleaguered, where do we place Nouri al-Maliki at this point?
Trying to remain polite. a pain in the butt. I mean, you know, clearly what has happened, what has become clear in the last few days, that this isn't a few odd-bod ISIS fighters. They have sparked off a revolt from the Sunni population in the north. That's how they've been operating. That's quite clear. And Maliki has done his damn best to keep them isolated, to keep them persecuted.
It is worth remembering that before this recent blitzkrieg across the northwest, ISIS or affiliated had been more or less in control of towns like Ramadi and Fallujah, not far from Baghdad to the west.
Well, when we say ISIS, it's a bit like what I compare it to in my own journalistic experience is the IRA in Belfast. It didn't take many of them to control an area. What it did take was the passive acceptance or even enthusiasm of the local population. And I think ISIS are not many, but they have the passive support of a very alienated Sunni minority, a significant Sunni minority. And that has been the problem with Iraq for many years, that democracy, simple majoritarian democracy, has a problem in a divided society. It's not sufficient simply to say the Maliki's Shiite party got 51% of the vote, we govern. Because as our experience in Northern Ireland, as actually any conflict and post-conflict situation shows, we have to nuance democracy. We have to try and respond to the divisions in society, and that's what he's not been doing.
Nina Schick, is there any interpretation or extrapolation or projection of events under which Nouri al-Maliki looks at all like part of the solution?
No, because actually this isn't a recent development. This is something that's been going on for years. Since 2010 already, Maliki has been pushing out Sunnis from the armed forces, for example. And already back in 2004 and 2005, I mean, you have to look at Iraq as a country. They primarily identify with their religious denominations or ethnicity as their identity, not Iraq, the nation, as identity. So if you therefore segregate and alienate huge sections of the society, not only the Sunnis, but also the Kurds, then inevitably people are going to turn to militia.
He made his weekly address to the nation today, Nouri al-Maliki, this is, muttering something about political forces, as he put it, reconciling for Iraq's greater good. Ivor, to the obviously limited extent that that means anything at all, is that actually likely to happen at this point, or are we past that?
I think we're past the situation where manoeuvrings, who's going to be appointed to government. He hasn't yet formed his provisional government yet. He is prime minister. He's defence minister. He's interior minister.
Busy man.
He's a busy, foolish man. And I wish I could show any optimism that Iraq could sustain itself in an existential sense under Maliki. I fear the Kurds have had enough. I mean, they've had enough a long time ago. They've taken advantage of the situation. I understand there are problems in the south, even though they're Shiites, they're very alienated. It gets to a situation where one can't see a way forward with Maliki at the helm.
Nina Sheikh, if Nouri al-Maliki was suddenly seized today with a sudden conciliatory impulse and a desire to be the man who saved his nation, is there any way he can make Iraq Sunnis start trusting him at this point? I mean, what has obviously happened was that for years the Shia majority were oppressed by a Sunni minority, and since they took power under democracy, they have rather been getting their own back, as it were. Is he somebody the Sunnis are ever going to trust?
Well, unfortunately, the outlook looks grim, and it's probably bound to get worse. If he had succeeded to this international pressure to have a more inclusive government, that would have been a first step in the right direction. However, because ISIS now has become so much of a force, it's not only a problem that's a problem for Iraq, but it's a problem for the entire region. I mean, only just now there's news breaking out that one of Al-Qaeda's Syria branches in Syria has decided to join forces with ISIS. And they were having months of battle. So the fact that this Sunni militant force is rising in the Middle East is troublesome, not only for Iraq, but the region as a whole.
This Iraq and the current situation there has dominated this part of Midori House for the last couple of weeks, quite understandably. A question I've been asking most of our guests who come through is that at what point, and I'll put this to you first, Ivor, at what point do you just give up on the idea of a country as a coherent whole? As you mentioned, the Kurds are becoming increasingly unambiguous about how they feel about the future of things.
Well, fortunately, it's not us who makes these decisions. Countries do fall apart, or sometimes they divide peacefully. One thinks of Czechoslovakia had a successful...
Indeed.
Sometimes...
The United Kingdom might be doing that later this year.
Yeah, it might not even be peaceable, but yeah. I think without a real centripetal force, I think it is, to stay together, then it's going to be easier for Iraq to disintegrate. However, let me now hastily add, that would be disastrous for Iraqi people, it would be disastrous for stability in the Middle East, and it would be disastrous actually for the world. Let me just shine one light, one slight ray of light, that there is a possibility that Maliki will not continue, that his deputy, Ayad Alawi, is the one who suggested a broader coalition, taking in Sunni and Kurdish elements. If in the July the 1st, which is when Maliki says he'll start forming his provisional government, there are sufficient allies of Alawi, then it's possible we might see a movement forward in Iraqi politics. But I can't remember how long Maliki's been there, but it's a long time. And dictators, whether they're elected or assume power, don't give up power easily.
OK, well, we'll move along now to some factional political infighting, which, while closer to where we are, is somewhat more peaceful. It would perhaps be an exaggeration to suggest that this issue is gripping bars and cafes across the continent, but the wrangle over who is to be the next president of the EU Commission is continuing. Jean-Claude Juncker, the former Prime Minister of Luxembourg, wants the job. David Cameron, the current Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, very much doesn't want him to have it. Nina Sheikh, we talked about this last week, I believe, attempting to divide why it was that David Cameron is so invested in a subject which really very few of the citizens of this country care about in the slightest. Where are we now since we last talked about it? Has it moved on at all?
So what's going to happen is that the European leaders will come together at a summit on Thursday and Friday, where for the first time on David Cameron's insistence, it will go to a vote who will get the Commission presidency. Now, David Cameron was correct in making this stand, because on the principles of democracy, which is those people supporting Juncker have been purveying it as though he's somehow the democratically elected candidate of the masses of Europe, which is absolutely ridiculous because most people in Europe don't even know who he is. And also because he's opposing it because this sets a very dangerous precedent, because this push to instill Juncker at the head of the Commission has been orchestrated by the European Parliament, and it's going to formalize an institutional power grab by the European Parliament to choose who should lead the Commission. And that's something that the European Council, which is where the heads of the EU member states sit, have always done so, and that's how it's also said it should be in the in the EU treaties. However, because of the weird, very weird way that European politics works, you now have this bizarre situation where none of the 28 heads of Europe actually believe that Juncker should have the job or even agree with the process by which this has come by. But because of domestic pressure, they can't oppose Juncker. So you'll have Cameron versus 26 member states, and possibly he'll have Hungary's Viktor Orban on his side as well.
Ivor Gaber, why do you think David Cameron is so invested in this? Is he worried that Juncker's appointment makes a UK exit from the EU more likely?
Well, I think he's worried for two reasons. I mean, firstly, this has as much, if not more, to do with internal Conservative Party politics and worrying about UKIP considerations than it does about Europe. He has a right wing to play to, and they don't believe he's sufficiently anti-European. But secondly, I think that Cameron's hopes, and I think they are genuine, that he could renegotiate a better deal and then go to an in-out referendum and get a yes, are severely damaged by the fact that he doesn't regard Mr. Juncker as a good negotiating ally. He thinks Juncker will be more difficult to persuade than another candidate. Can I just make one observation, just picking up on an earlier point? Yes, the masses of Europe did not rush to the polls and say we want Juncker, but I have to say that there was a Eurovision debate which was screened in every major European country on national television except in the UK. It wasn't available on any channel here, as far as I know. It could only be downloaded. Now, that's not a condemnation of Mr. Cameron or Mr. Miliband, for that matter. That's a condemnation of the broadcasters, that if they didn't pick up that many people, or at least many political parties in Europe, thought this election was about Juncker, that they missed a trick, because that was an event that they should have televised.
I detect a measure of scepticism,
yeah.
Nina.
No, I completely disagree, because the European parliamentary elections and the lead Spitzenkandidaten was not just broadcast in the UK, but in many countries across the EU. And secondly, this idea that's often pervaded in the media that Cameron is simply playing up to the Eurosceptic in his parties is very much simplified. In fact, the Eurosceptics, as we call them, the better off outers, the people who want the UK to leave the EU, say, yeah, great, you know, let's put Juncker there. That will fire up our cause. So the fact that Cameron is making this stand actually shows him to be a man of principle. And again, I'd like to point out, we follow this every single day. We monitor the press and talk to other politicians across Europe. It's not only the UK that opposes Juncker. There is no other EU head of state who in private would support Juncker. So Cameron
public, it's only Hungary, isn't it, who supports him?
It's only
Hungary in public who are prepared to join Cameron.
Yes, we initially had Netherlands and Sweden on side as well. But because you've come to this situation, well, it's very complicated, but because of a domestic twist in German politics, because Merkel has supported Juncker, she's the ultimate power player in when it comes to European politics. And if you have an impossible situation where you pit Berlin against London, you can trust yourself that all the other EU states are going to choose Berlin and not London.
Is there, I'll come back to you, Ivor, is there the remotest chance that when this is all the dust settles, Jean-Claude, I've said his name so often now I've forgotten how to say it, Jean-Claude Juncker isn't going to get the job?
Well, the process of appointment is a pretty murky anyway. It's normally done, it has always been done previously by consensus, which is a difficult bit. This would be the first time there'd be a hands-up vote. So we don't have, I don't think there is a laid down process. The chairman of the president of the commission emerges. At the moment, I think you'd have to be a very foolish man to bet against him.
Nina Schick?
Well, there's pretty much, it looks, it's going to be Juncker. That's pretty much certain. What's going to happen is it's going to go to a vote, which will be, as Ivor pointed out, the first time in history that that will happen. But because of those of us who believe that EU reform is possible, there's a hope that because Cameron will be so much humiliated and because all the other EU leaders are actually privately thinking what Cameron is saying publicly, that there will be more concessions for Cameron down the line.
Okay, well, on that note, we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, Ivor Gaber and Nina Schick. When we return, we'll ask if Russia is serious about backing out of Ukraine, and we'll see if we can think of something to say about Luis Suarez other than that he's a horrible, diving, biting, whining cheat.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It is a beautiful brand that it's all about giving the consumer the best possible product. We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
We put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said Brand Strategy Company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad poets and really didn't get what we were about.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
You get obsessed about the details. And if you're making the same product day in, day out, you build this incredible product that is very difficult to replicate.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Ivor Gaber of City University here in London, Nina Schick of the Open Europe think tank. At the risk of tempting fate, then, is the semi-war between Ukraine and Russia over? At the request of President Vladimir Putin, Russia's parliament has revoked the powers it had granted him to send Russian troops across the border. This is being seen as a goodwill gesture, albeit in the same way that it's sort of a goodwill gesture when the bully stops beating you up. Ivor Gaber, is this at least the beginning of the end? Do we think?
I think it's the beginning of the end of Putin's ability to control what's happening in eastern Ukraine.
Which may be a thought that's occurred to him.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that on the very day that he leans on Parliament to repeal the permission to invade, I'm trying to think how to describe them. The West call them terrorists, the separatists, the pro-Moscow, whatever we want to call them, shoot down a helicopter and continue to disregard the ceasefire, which they had only announced a day or two ago they were going to accept. There are two explanations, or three explanations. I'm not sure how many I'll get through. One is Putin is being very clever and saying one thing and not wanting to upset Merkel and the West of the international community by saying, oh, look, we're not doing anything, but is secretly encouraging. Secondly, that he's losing control. Or thirdly, it's a Russian enigma. Something is happening so deep and so clever that I don't know what it is. But we're in an odd situation at the moment, and I did think it's very difficult to decide who's in control of what's going on in eastern Ukraine.
Nina Schick, Putin can presumably at any point request that Parliament restore this power to him. So does this gesture actually mean anything, or is it a kind of... is it a cosmetic gesture?
Well, I think that Putin is very much trying to balance patriotism with politics here, because although he's made this gesture, which has been welcomed by the West, let's not forget that there's still this ongoing gas row with Ukraine. They've switched off gas supplies to Ukraine, and they've also said that if Ukraine signs this trade association agreement with the EU, which is bound to happen now and will be discussed later this week, that they could take sanctions against Ukraine. However, as Ivor correctly pointed out, I think what Putin is trying to do is balance his strategic interests without losing too much face. I think a full-scale Russian military invasion of Ukraine is unlikely. And let's not forget that the pro-Russian separatists who are fighting in Ukraine serve a purpose for the Kremlin, but no further than that. And it's interesting, I think, to see that actually the Ukrainian president, the new Ukrainian president Poroshenko and Putin are not that far off a deal, actually, because what Putin has been demanding is a federalist state in Ukraine. And though Poroshenko won't give him that, he will agree for more autonomy to the eastern regions in Ukraine and regionally elected governors in the eastern regions of Ukraine. Now, this is strategically important to Russia because that prevents them. The hope is that by allowing these regional leaders in eastern Ukraine to have more power, then Ukraine will never fully assimilate with the Western world. And this is it's NATO membership, which is the big thing that Russia does not want Ukraine to go.
So do we think then, and I'll ask you first, Ivor, whether his recent adventures this year in Ukraine have served his purpose? Is Putin got everything he wants? He's got Crimea. He has got skyrocketing approval ratings at home. Two-thirds of Russians are now hoping he stays for a fourth term. And he has a certain amount of leverage over Ukraine and at least has kept Ukraine out of EU and NATO for the foreseeable future.
I think certainly in the very short term, the answer to your question is yes. I think, as I suggested, that he might be losing control, if that's the right word, of the separatists, which could be problematic. But I think in the long term, he's done. Is it damage? He's certainly restored the Cold War. He's certainly made international cooperation that much more difficult. Okay, he's waved the big stick, but he's not seen, I think, in international circles as a reliable partner. And I think Russia, in fact, in Syria, they'd sort of achieved it. He'd become a reliable, maybe reliable is the wrong word, a man I can do business with, as Mrs. Thatcher once said of Gorbachev. I don't think Western leaders see Putin as reliable, and I think that will be a long-term damage to Russia's standing.
Nina, do you think Putin's got mostly what he wanted out of this?
I think so. And I think, as I mentioned, he's now trying to play a very fine balancing act, because when the crisis in Ukraine first started, he kicked up a patriotic fervor in his country saying, you know, we want to protect the Russian-speaking minorities in eastern Ukraine. And you saw how the state propaganda was always referring to the fascist forces in Kiev. And now, recently, that's taken an interesting turn, because now the state-sponsored propaganda has been more tempered in its tone and, interestingly, has not been critical of Poroshenko. So, therefore, I would say that Putin would like to strike a deal with Poroshenko, but now, all of a sudden, even though his popularity skyrocketed as a result of the Ukraine crisis, you are seeing critical voices in Russia coming up and criticizing Putin for not stepping up to the plate and not launching a military invasion of Ukraine. And he will that will be something for him to balance, how he can maintain his political gain without losing too much face.
Okay, and finally, for the third time in his eventful career, Uruguay's gifted but infuriating striker Luis Suarez has bitten an opponent, to the delight at least of a few dozen gamblers who took advantage of one bookmaker's pre-World Cup publicity stunt, offering what turned out to be a generous 175-1 against Suarez applying his prominent fangs to yet another defender. Nina Schick, I will ask you first, should more of us have piled in at those odds?
Certainly. I mean, looking at his track record, it's seems like a good bet to have made. I mean, he is a terrific football player, single-handedly kind of pushing Uruguay through the World Cup, but he is an awful person. His response to this was, physical contact is part of the game. We're all football players. We should know this. But he's been a villain in the World Cup on previous occasions as well, including kicking out what was going into the goal, into the Uruguayan goal, kicking Ghana out of the World Cup last time. So he's someone we love to hate.
It was particularly sad. I was there at that game. This was the first World Cup in South Africa. Ghana were going to be the first African team to get to the semi-finals. Mind you, they had themselves blamed. They missed the subsequent penalty. Let me just add about Suarez. I don't know if he's a horrible man, but he's certainly somebody one would want to tangle.
The evidence would appear to be tending in that direction.
I'll tell you what I'm going to say. I think it's a very sad, apart from everything else, he had spent last season resurrecting his reputation. He'd been suspended for biting the Chelsea player. He'd had the problems with racial abuse. He came back. He played brilliantly.
He did.
He did all the right things in PR terms, or at least his PR manager made him do all the right terms. He was voted Footballer of the Year by the English soccer writers. And then he blows it all. And that's really sad, because I think it's going to be really difficult for him to come back and play in England again.
We did also see, talking about Ghana's narrow failure to proceed in 2006, we saw Ivory Coast deprived yesterday by a last-minute penalty given for a foul, which to my eyes at least did not look like it involved a great deal of actual contact. Our condolences to Ivory Coast. We will have to leave it there. Ivor Gaber and Nina Schick, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyoist. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's show. We'll get the latest from our man in Nairobi, and we'll be speaking to the author of Joyriding in Riyadh. Before we start on all that, Suzanne Chislett has the headlines.
Thank you, Andrew. Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has rejected international calls to form a new all-inclusive government to shore up support against the Sunni militants. He used his weekly address to say such a move would mark an end to democracy in Iraq. Members of al-Qaeda in Syria have pledged their support to ISIS in at least one key border town. The Sunni insurgent groups continuing to battle government forces. Today it seized control of a major airbase in Iraq as well as several small oil fields. The presidents of Russia, Germany, France and Ukraine have held a joint phone conference to discuss the situation in Ukraine. The Kremlin says Vladimir Putin called for the temporary ceasefire between Kiev and some separatist rebel groups to be extended beyond Friday. There are reports at least 10 people have been killed in a bomb attack in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. It happened near a busy shopping centre. Local hospitals say many people were injured. And the lawyer of Princess Cristina, sister of the King of Spain, has announced she will appeal against the decision to formally charge her in a corruption case. Along with her husband, the princess is accused of tax fraud and money laundering in Palma de Mallorca. They've denied the charges. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Suzanne. Welcome back to Midori House, live here from Studio One on Monocle 24. It's 21:32 in Moscow, which makes it 18:32 here in London, 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro, near to which at least it's currently Nigeria 2, Argentina 3. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Nairobi. A short while ago, I spoke to Monocle's correspondent there, Tristan McConnell. Well, first of all, Tristan, you are recently back in Nairobi from South Sudan, rather, one of the world's newer countries and one which is not going terrifically well so far.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's almost 3 years ago that South Sudan got its independence and became the world's newest nation. And it was born with a great deal of international goodwill. But over the last 6 months, all of that has been squandered. And really, the country has been set back many years. It all started with a political fight between the president and his former deputy, and then that's kind of spiraled into ethnic conflict that spread across much of the country. Now, what I was doing when I went there about 10 days ago was to see the kind of consequences of that conflict. So I visited a part of the country called Unity State, which is an oil-rich, oil-producing part of the country that's been badly afflicted by the fighting. People have been uprooted from their homes. Their homes have been destroyed, their grain stores have been destroyed, their crops have been destroyed. And what we're seeing there, and this is a big concern, is the beginnings of famine, essentially. There is a horrendous malnutrition that's particularly affecting young kids, who are obviously the weakest. And in the town of Lair, where I was, they were already having, you know, almost 2,000 children on a feeding program. And this is just the beginning, really. Most of the people that I interacted with, you know, they haven't been able to plant any crops, which means there will be no harvest later this year. So if people are hungry now, it's going to be a whole lot worse in a few months' time. And this is something that, you know, everyone involved in South Sudan, except perhaps the political leaders, are very concerned about.
Did you get any sense that the famine aspect as a corollary of the conflict is being deliberately orchestrated, or is it just an accidental consequence of fighting that nobody's really given all that much thought to?
I didn't get the sense that this was a deliberate strategy of the war to try and starve anyone out, but it is a very foreseeable consequence of the fighting, and one that the political leaders who are behind the conflict knew would happen and have done nothing to prevent. I mean, you know, when the government soldiers rolled through the town of Leh, the destruction was pretty wholesale. I mean, they attacked the hospital, but more importantly, when they went to people's homes, they destroyed their stores where they kept the grain, which meant that even when people are able to return, they've got nothing to plant. In that respect, yes, it was a deliberate attempt to make sure that life becomes unlivable for these people. But to describe it as a kind of strategy of the conflict, I think is perhaps going too far. But what is very clear is that the leaders who are sitting in Addis Ababa at a very expensive hotel, holding a lot of talks that don't go anywhere, care very little for the ordinary people on the ground who are facing starvation at the moment.
What was your sense of the actual fighting taking place in South Sudan, and where is it on the scale of conflict between sort of semi-spontaneous, semi-organized local militias and actual orchestrated warfare between reasonably coherent formations?
Yeah, I mean, it's ebbed and flowed. I mean, when I was there, the rainy season has begun, and it's pretty hard to fight during the rainy season. Whatever roads are there disappear, so any tanks and vehicles you've got can't be moved. So essentially, the fighting has kind of stalled for the time being. I mean, there is also a peace deal, a ceasefire that was signed, but it's more to do with the weather than any pieces of paper up in Ethiopia. But the fighting has had pretty much every aspect that you've described is there. There have been sort of very disorganized tribal militias who essentially fight in order to feed themselves and don't really take much command from anyone. And there have been, you know, entire units and brigades of the army that have defected and have then turned on one another with tanks and artillery and so on. So it's a very diverse kind of conflict. And, you know, in some cases involves everything you would expect from, well, maybe not modern armies, but, you know, a pretty well-equipped African army going at it against another branch of itself, down to, you know, just local skirmishes with guys with, in some cases, you know, spears and bows and arrows. So we're running the whole gamut of conflict in South Sudan.
And just finally, we should move on to Monday's imprisoning of Al Jazeera journalist Peter Gresty and two of his colleagues on an assortment of bizarre and preposterous charges by a court in Cairo. This is being felt, I understand, a little more deeply than in most places among the journalist community in Nairobi.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Peter is both a good friend to many of us here as well as a pretty daunting competition. He's lived in Nairobi for years, and we're quite a big but a fairly close community of foreign correspondents here. So to see what happened to him, you know, he was basically doing a bit of Christmas cover for some other correspondents, going up to Cairo out of his normal patch when he was arrested. And, you know, the shock of this outrageous kind of sentencing that we heard on Monday is being, you know, it's really reverberating around the journalists here, perhaps more than elsewhere around the world, where we've seen this kind of incredible kind of solidarity. I mean, I think a lot of people are aware of the kind of campaign, such as it is, this sort of publicity campaign to raise awareness, but it seems increasingly clear that the military leaders in Egypt are not paying the blindest bit of attention to the uproar that is being caused by the treatment of these journalists. And it is, I hate to say it, making a lot of us feel pretty hopeless. You know, what can we do to get him out? And at the moment, you know, we'll keep up the campaign, but it's seeming to have very little impact.
We can only hope that the uproar continues. Tristan McConnell in Nairobi, thanks very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll meet Pascal Minoret, author of Joyriding in Riyadh, which, as unlikely as it might sound, is a book about exactly that. Do stay with us.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring?
If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because dragstar taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Now, as demonstrated by recent events in Iraq and by uncountable other examples, it's arguable that the world faces no more pressing concern than finding something useful for the young males of the Middle East to do. Too many of them are deprived of opportunity by poverty, and a minority of them by wealth. They mostly live in places which are corrupt or dysfunctional or both, and are caught between the demands of their faith and the temptations of modernity, most of which is the case in Saudi Arabia more than most places. And Saudi Arabia is not a place usually indulgent of questioning from outside. An exception is Pascal Minoret, Assistant Professor of Middle Eastern Studies at NYU Abu Dhabi, and now author of Joyriding in Riyadh, a survey of Saudi youth culture. He joins us now from our studio in New York. Pascal, I want to start with the rather eye-catching title of your book. Is joyriding in Riyadh a thing that literally happens? And if so, how does it happen and when does it happen?
Yes, joyriding in Riyadh is something that happens since roughly the mid-70s. I call the book Joyriding in Riyadh. I mean, it's a very imprecise translation of the Saudi colloquial word that describes what I'm talking about. The word is tafhit, which means both joyriding, stealing cars, and then drifting them at high speed.
So who are the kids who do this?
Well, they're mostly kids from impoverished urban backgrounds, and what's very interesting is that a majority of them belong to communities, to recent urban communities, communities that came from the Saudi countryside, from the mountains, from the steppes of central Najd, and who've had a hard time integrating into the city.
It's not necessarily unusual for young, poor men who are a bit bored to do dumb things with cars to amuse themselves. It happens in most places. What did you find that was distinctive about the car culture in Saudi Arabia?
Well, what's distinctive about that scene is that it's extremely lethal. There are lots of accidents. It's the scale of it. It's the fact that week after week, since more than 30 years, since roughly the oil boom of the mid-70s, throngs of kids steal cars and destroy them at high speed on urban avenues, on urban thoroughfares. And so the scale of that movement is very, very impressive.
And how were you able to get access to this subculture? Saudi Arabia is not an easy place even to go to for people who are attempting any sort of journalistic enterprise, and getting access to people can't be easy.
Yeah, it took me a long time to actually get access. I wrote my first book in the early 2000s. It's called The Saudi Enigma. It was published in London in 2005, and this I think gave me some kind of better access to the country. I think that the Saudi elites didn't dislike that first book. They thought it was fair to the country, and so I was granted a 4 years research visa.
And how do the ordinary people of Saudi Arabia, the people you were writing about, what's the general reaction to a foreigner with a notepad asking them questions?
Mukhabarat. It's intelligence, of course. I mean, I must be working either for the CIA or for the Saudi intelligence, and it's been fairly common since a few decades to actually see foreigners with notepads working with the Saudi police.
Is the phenomenon you're talking about, specifically about the joyriders, is it an exclusively male phenomenon? I mean, it's a male-dominated phenomenon in most places it happens, but obviously it may be more so for reasons pertaining to the legal framework of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, it's a male-dominated phenomenon in Saudi. Women don't have the right to drive, and although there are a few women, a few girls, right, joyriding cars in Saudi, it's mainly a male scene. The book is really about Riyadh, actually. I mean, despite the title. And it's about the making of the city since the 1970s. making of the city by a few Western experts, actually European experts, who built a city or who designed a city that looks pretty much like a South Californian car-based, car-oriented suburb. And so that was the first question I encountered. Why did these European urbanists, Greeks and French, design an American city in Saudi Arabia, and what are the consequences of that design for people's daily lives?
I mean, wasn't that always inevitable? I mean, Riyadh is a fairly new city, certainly compared to a lot of other Arab cities. It would be not really any more these days practical or even desirable to make a more traditional Arab city, I guess, on the lines of, I guess, you know, somewhere really built up and confusing and chaotic like Cairo or Jerusalem.
Well, as a matter of fact, the old center of Riyadh is as chaotic and as interesting, as rich, as multi-layered as many places in Cairo or in Baghdad. Riyadh is a fairly recent city, but not that recent. The urban core dates back from the 17th century, and it could have been possible to actually design the city in other ways. What we have in Riyadh is a case study of modern urban planning of post-World War II car-based urban planning, and it would have been avoidable. Actually, the city could have developed in other ways. What explains why the city developed that way is that weird alliance between European urban planners on the one hand and the Saudi elites on the other hand. The princes were very hungry for new investments, for pockets, economic pockets to open to the local bourgeoisie, and for opportunities to open to local businesses. And so they created that huge real estate sector that's basically overdeveloped the city. And that's basically the reason why Riyadh now looks like some places in Texas or Arizona or South California.
Did you get a sense of what this generation of young Saudis or even young Riyadis might grow into? Obviously, they are going to be not necessarily the poorer disenfranchised people who joyride in cars, but their peers are going to be born into a position of enormous wealth and influence. Given that so few Westerners get direct access to Saudi Arabia, what's something we should know or should understand about young Saudis that we don't?
Well, I guess what we should understand from the outside is that there is an enormous level of political and economic violence in the country. There is a scene I recount in the book. It's at the Riyadh Chamber of Commerce, and a very prominent businessman who is the grandson of the first Saudi finance minister is addressing a crowd of young businessmen, and basically what he tells them is, "Do not innovate. You can do fairly well by just importing successful products into Saudi Arabia, but do not try to innovate." And I think that message, that very powerful message from the Saudi elites, is directly connected to the kind of violence I observed on the streets of Riyadh. There is something tremendously disempowering in the attitude of the Saudi elites toward their own youth.
Pascal Manore, author of Joyriding in Riyadh, Oil, Urbanism and Road Revolt, available now. Thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still Nigeria 2, Argentina 3, and on a related note, it's time now for the latest installment in our series of alternative World Cup anthems. And for this episode, we're heading to Switzerland, which finds it easier to rally around the regional rather than the national. But you can may be reassured in advance that this song features a relative lack of men in leather shorts blowing enormous trumpets on hillsides.
Switzerland is a so-called voluntary nation, meaning that apart from an idea and economic interests, nothing really holds the four linguistic regions together. So therefore, we also don't have one song that, you know, would unify us or provoke this sort of patriotic feeling. So every linguistic region then has a type of music that would create a sense of space or home. And the one I picked this, because I'm from the east of Switzerland, is Zäuerle, which is from the mountains in the east. Soil is a form of yodel, a yodel without a text. So it is mainly sung by men. Traditionally, it would have been herdsmen. And they all stand in a circle with their hands in their pockets, and they look really stern and concentrated. And then one starts, and he starts by just singing one melody. And then the choir around him goes above him and below him, and they create this beautiful harmony. The term zoile comes from an old term for cheering, and the cheer comes from the way the herdsman would have called his cows and his goats on the Alp. This sort of singing goes back to about the 16th century, and it's very much like an appreciation for the mountains and nature, and it kind of picks up the old tales of the old ghosts and the old mystical land of the mountains. Today, rural Switzerland doesn't play such a big part. Lots of the young people, they move to the cities and try to find happiness there or go abroad. But I do think that this music reminds you of maybe the inner mountaineer in you, or this almost this longing for the mountains. I think there's also a trend back to, you know, finding the regional and finding the authentic and this sort of singing and the way these singers are also dressed and all the whole ritual and tradition around it has seen a big revival in recent years. I think as a Swiss person, you very much associate with an idea rather than an actual reality. So you would feel like from that region, because you also have a certain dialect, there's 24 different dialects and or even more. And the idea for Swissness, I think it's you could maybe pin it down to certain produce or an education system or a health system, but it isn't really a tangible thing. And so that's why I was also struggling to find a song. I think these old melodies are maybe the closest that you can get to a sense of Swissness. When I hear it, it gives me goosebumps every time, because it reminds me of my childhood on these hills and in these mountains and the forests, and makes me a bit homesick as well.
Isabel Kaiser there on the Yodelers of Eastern Switzerland, their nation's alternative national anthem. We'll bring you more installments of that series on the World Cup's alternative national anthems throughout the tournament in Brazil here on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's time now to review the best, sometimes the worst, from the worlds of the arts. Today we're talking dance. We're joined now by Louise Levine, the dance critic for the Financial Times. Louise, welcome to the show.
Hello.
First of all, the first production you wanted to talk about was a version of a, well, it's a dance production about dance productions of a sort.
In a way. It's something I'm rather excited about. It premieres on Friday, but I've seen a lot of rehearsal. And it's about the dance marathons of the 1920s and 30s. Now, this is actually, there have been lots of adaptations of the very famous novel on the subject by Horace McCoy, They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And there have been musicals, there have been plays, and of course the famous 1969 film with Jane Fonda. And it appeals to performers generally, I think. I think they like that idea of someone kind of working themselves into the ground with, and dancers especially, you know, as Baryshnikov once said, if it's not hurting, you're not a dancer. But this isn't actually a version of the book for quite complicated copyright reasons, but it's a very exciting thing. It's being done in the round with 11 professional performers and about two dozen what we call community dancers. Now, when I hear that expression, I normally reach for my sharpest pen. But it's
Actually, the phrase community in anything.
Yes.
You put the word community in front of everything, and it's just generally a warning.
Absolutely. But this is being done really well, and it's a great subject, and it's being done in Greenwich, then in Ipswich 2 weeks later with a whole load of different community dancers, and it culminates with a performance at the Opera House in London, at the Royal Opera House, in the Floral Hall, which is this old giant greenhouse at the side of the Opera House, which is now the bar and the hub of the building. And they're going to turn it into a kind of fly-blown 30s dance hall with loads of bunting and dirty American flags. And they're going to take us through it. Now, it could go horribly wrong, but I don't think it's going to, because they had 100 hours of research last year. They actually tried doing it.
They tried doing an actual dance marathon.
Yeah, with just a couple of hours sleep a night and dancing, and of course really dancing, because in the 30s the golden rule was keep moving. You know, if you stopped moving, you were out, but you weren't really dancing. I mean, very occasionally you'd be asked to do a specialty or something, but basically you were conserving your energy. But these guys were dancing, working out choreography for 100 solid hours, camping in Greenwich Borough Hall, can you believe it, and getting to feel what it was like, if it was possible to sleep while dancing, which apparently it is. So that's exciting and suggests that they've really gone into it quite thoroughly. But also, it's being done by Arthur Peter, and Arthur Peter is really good news. He used to be with Adventures in Motion Pictures, you know, who were famous for the Swan Lake with the male swans and so on. And then he started choreographing, and he's everywhere. You know, he choreographed the musical The Bodyguard, he choreographed La Boheme in the Round at the Albert Hall, and then he choreographed a version of Kafka's Metamorphosis at the Opera House with Ed Watson from the Royal Ballet. And it was this extraordinary production, tremendously physical. The man, you know, really does become an insect. And the whole stage, it was staged in the Round, is covered bit by bit in treacle. The smell alone was extraordinary.
Well, he clearly can't be faulted for dedication to his craft. That's Arthur Peter's new version or imminent version of They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
Oh, it's called The World's Greatest Show, and it's not They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
It's definitely not called They Shoot Horses, Don't They? It's called The World's Greatest Show, which is, I mean, it has to be good, because that's just asking for trouble from the critics, if it isn't, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
You also wanted to move along to something happening at Sadler's Wells.
Yes, well, every year they do this marvellous thing called Sample, where they rip out half the stall seats, fill the foyers and stairwells with free workshops and dance performances and films and activities for families and interested types, and give a lot of different variety of performances. It ends this weekend with a kind of royal variety performance, if you like, called Playlist, where you get everything from the Donquille Pas de Deux, you know, absolute classical ballet, to hip-hop, in this very kind of convivial environment, because you've got a little promenade section at the front. And I think this is very good, because it will include quite a lot of contemporary dance. And the thing sometimes with contemporary dance, particularly in a one choreographer company, is that you get, it's all good, but it's all of a piece. You know, it's very nourishing, but it's like a great big bowl of polenta. You know, you want some, you know, gravy on it. And this, the variety, I think, is very sexy and exciting. So that'll be nice.
Just finally, and extremely quickly, Brazil Brasileiro is back at the Peacock from the 8th of July.
It's at Sadler's Wells. It's at the main theatre. And they're putting back the seats. That's the sad part, because you've got 27 dancers, 10 musicians, and the rhythms of Brazil. How are you going to keep still?
Louise Levine, dance critic for the FT, thank you very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's episode. My thanks in particular to our earlier special guests, Ivor Gaber and Nina Schick. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Carlotta Rabello, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. Next up, after the headlines, The Entrepreneurs, 2200 The Monocle Daily. I'll be back with Georgina Godwin for that. This show returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.